Well, thank you very much, Mofolula Soa, for that very generous introduction. And I'd like to thank Uncle Alan for his wonderful, warm welcome to country today. It is a real treat for those of us who are non-Indigenous to share this land with the people whose history goes back 60,000 years. And I think Uncle Alan reminded us of that honour in his welcome to country today. I'd also like to thank the organisers for allowing me to address you on a topic that is a passion of mine, using better evidence to build a fairer society and a stronger economy. And as we navigate an era marked by rapid technological advancements and shifting workplace dynamics, the role of human resources has never been more critical. HR is the backbone of organisations, ensuring not just compliance and management, but also fostering a culture of growth, innovation, and inclusion. At its best, HR helps unlock workers' full potential, aligns individual aspirations with organisational goals, and builds resilient structures that thrive in the face of challenges. HR isn't just a support function, but a driver of organisational success. And within the Australian Public Service, human resources is one of the three professions that cross-cut agencies and look to build expertise right across the public service. And yet for HR to succeed, you need more than gut instinct. As the cliche goes, in God we trust, all others must bring data. If your company faces no competitors at all for your products and employees, then maybe you can get away with making decisions based on fill opinions. But for mere mortals, and for most organisations, evidence matters. And in this short address, I want to run you through a few of my favourite examples of evidence-based policy making in human resources, presenting some surprising findings from a succession of randomised trials. I'll then turn to why randomised trials should typically be given more weight than other forms of evidence, and how we're seeking to use them in government. So, let's look at how some randomised trials in human resources might teach us. Mental illness not only hurts the sufferer, but can also be costly to employers. Those who are struggling mentally can't perform at their best in the workplace. And mental ill health is one of the leading causes of long-term workplace absence. Might mental wellbeing training for managers help? Well, to test this, Fire and Rescue New South Wales conducted a randomised trial. The service recruited 128 duty commanders for the experiment. Half of the managers were randomly assigned to a four-hour face-to-face respect mental health training program. The other half, randomly selected, were assigned to a wait list to receive the training 3 months later. The researchers then looked at whether there was any difference in the sick leave of those firefighters supervised by those who'd received the training. Over coming months, they found a significant drop in sick leave in the treatment group. Firefighters whose managers had received the training were one-third less likely to take sick leave. After a matter of months, the control group then received the training. Or take another experiment. At the Tomago aluminium smelter north of Newcastle, human resources managers were concerned about the physical health of employees. Shift work is correlated with obesity, and the smelter were keen to assist employees who wanted to lose weight. So researchers recruited 110 overweight or obese men who worked in the smelter and were keen to lose weight. Half were randomly assigned to a weight loss program. The other half were randomly assigned to a wait list control group. The chosen weight loss program was known as POWER, which was a backronym standing for Preventing Obesity Without Eating Like a Rabbit. Men in the program attended a 75-minute information session and were provided with a weight loss handbook, a pedometer, and online resources that encouraged them to reduce their energy intake and increase their energy expenditure. There was also a competitive element to POWER. The crew with the greatest weight loss would each receive a $50 voucher to be spent at a local sporting goods store. Over the first 14 weeks, men in the power program lost 4.3 kilograms more than those in the control group. A significant drop in a group where the average weight started at 95 kilograms. Because of the way the intervention was designed, it wasn't possible to assess the long-term impacts. After 3 months, the control group were eligible to participate in the program. But given that many weight loss programs produce zero short-term effects, this one is kind of promising. It would also be terrific to have further randomised trials that could help unpack whether the program worked because of the information aspect or the competitive aspect. Outside Australia, human resources experiments have looked at the impact of incentives on employees. In one fascinating experiment, a large insurance company was refurbishing the offices of 198 staff in the underwriting department. While the work was being done, employees were temporarily assigned to different offices. Some randomly got an office that was of higher status than their co-workers. Others were assigned to lower status offices, and the rest were put in offices that were of equal status to their co-workers. Relative to workers who were assigned to equal status offices, those employees put in high status offices raised their performance. Likewise, those in low status offices dropped their performance. While that fascinating finding tells us a lot about what status matters, it's easy to imagine it might not generalise to every setting. Could a view of Sydney Harbour be so distracting that it lowers productivity? Only a well-designed experiment could tell us the answer. One of the key issues in human resources management is how people are paid. In Britain, an experiment with fruit pickers analysed how they performed under two different pay structures: piece rates or relative incentives. Under the piece rate system, the workers were simply paid a flat rate for each kilogram of fruit. Under the system of relative incentives, the day's pay rates depended on how much the average worker picked. To test which system was better, researchers conducted a randomised trial involving 142 workers who were switched between the two pay systems. Before the experiment began, managers liked the relative incentive system. But as the workers quickly figured out, relative incentives come with a cost. Working harder pushes up the average output, which effectively lowers everyone's pay. In economic jargon, hard workers impose a negative externality on their co-workers. The randomised experiment found that workers were 50% less productive under the system of relative incentives, especially when they worked alongside their friends. Let me emphasise that point. Under the pay system that managers liked, workers were 50% less productive than under the system that performed best in a rigorous experiment. In another experiment on the same farm, the researchers carried out a randomised trial to test the effect of incentive pay for managers. They found that when managers were paid according to the productivity of their teams, average output per worker hour rose. But they also found that the variation in performance grew. Faced with a financial incentive to boost output, managers targeted their efforts towards more able workers. They began to ignore those workers who were struggling the most. What about the effect of working from home? In 2010, Ctrip, a large Chinese travel agency in Shanghai, was curious to see the impact of working from home for its call centre employees. So they asked for volunteers to participate in a randomised experiment on working from home. In total, 249 of their Chinese workers put their hands up. Among this group, Ctrip allowed employees with an even-numbered birth date to work from home, while those with an odd-numbered birth date continued to work from the office as usual. When the 9-month period was up, Ctrip found that those who'd worked from home were 13% more productive. Those people made more calls per minute, which they attributed to the quieter working environment. And they took fewer sick days. Home workers reported being more satisfied with their work, and they were less likely to quit. However, after adjusting for their improvement in productivity, they're also less likely to be promoted, perhaps because they were out of sight, out of mind, although the study also discusses other possible reasons. While the post-COVID debate over working from home rages, the C-TRIP study remains one of the most convincing pieces of evidence as to the impact of working from home. One final human resources experiment. Last year, 758 management consultants from BCG, representing a full 7% of BCG's global workforce, participated in a controlled study to assess the impact of artificial intelligence on productivity. These consultants were tasked with various assignments for a hypothetical shoe company, encompassing creative challenges such as generating at least 10 new shoe ideas for an overlooked market or sport, analytical challenges such as categorising the footwear market by consumer segments, and tasks focused on writing and marketing, such as composing a press release for a new product. Additionally, they tackled persuasive challenges, such as writing a motivational memo to employees that highlights the superiority of their product over competitors. Half the BCG consultants performed these tasks using traditional methods, while the other half incorporated ChatGPT into their workflow. The group using artificial intelligence significantly outperformed the others, completing tasks 25% quicker and producing outcomes that were 40% more exceptional in quality. That difference is comparable to what you might expect between a novice and a seasoned employee. The study also highlighted that AI served as an equaliser of skills. People who initially scored lower on skill assessments saw the most improvements in AI usage, though high performers also showed benefits, albeit to a lesser extent. The researchers also identified scenarios where tasks were intentionally assigned that stretched the capability of AI, leading to poorer performance by those using AI, a situation researchers call falling asleep at the wheel. Now, my purpose in describing these studies isn't to persuade you that workplace mental well-being and weight loss programs always work. I'm not trying to persuade you that piece rates are invariably effective, that working from home always works, or that every task can be improved through artificial intelligence. Instead, what I want to do is to encourage a mindset of humble experimentation over brash overconfidence. In human resources, as in politics, you'll come across plenty of leaders who are certain that their theories are right. The question you should always ask is, how good is your evidence and how can we make it better? Stronger evaluation is the breakthrough that can assist policymakers solve some of the challenges faced by successive governments, irrespective of who they are, such as why one-third of Australian students continue to struggle at reading, or why half of working-age people with a disability are outside the workforce, or why 2 in 5 released prisoners are back behind bars after 2 years. Our government's committed to meeting those challenges, and strengthened evaluation will be a tool we use to assist us. To build the evidence base, the Australian government announced last year the creation of the Australian Centre for Evaluation. Housed in the Commonwealth Treasury, the Australian Centre for Evaluation is tasked with working across government to encourage more high-quality evaluations, particularly randomised trials. Too often, past governments have run ad hoc pilot programs. The trouble with many pilot programs is it's hard to know what to compare the outcomes to. As evaluators put it, with a pilot program, there isn't a clear counterfactual. And that's why we're looking to carry out more randomised trials across government, providing insights as to what works in social policy programs, education programs and employment programs. Just as marketing companies use A/B testing to increase their impact, we're looking at opportunities to A/B test the many letters, emails and messages the government sends to Australians. We're not just trusting our intuitions, we're using science to better serve the public. One of the myths about randomised trials is that they take decades and cost millions. Yet plenty of organisations have built randomised trials into their parts of their business. Every time you use Google, you're participating in multiple randomised trials, a demonstration of the fact that big data is no substitute for experimentation. One insider has quipped that every pixel on the Amazon home screen has had to justify itself through randomised trials. 1 in 100 Coles Flybuy customers are randomly selected into a control group that receives no advertising materials, allowing Coles managers to test the impact of their marketing campaigns. In the quest to improve government, funders recognise that insights from randomised trials can have an outsized impact on policy. In the US, Arnold Ventures funds a range of randomised trials on social policy, many of which are conducted on a small budget. In the UK, the Education Endowment Foundation, the most successful of the UK What Works centres, has conducted over 100 randomised trials to see what works in school education and what doesn't. As the Australian Centre for Evaluation recognises, ethics must be at the heart of evaluation. The same holds true in business. If you're surrounded by people who are sceptical of randomised trials, it can be helpful to use a waitlist design, as some of the experiments I've described have done. In the end, everyone gets the program. The only difference is the treatment group gets it before the control group. Fundamentally, my advocacy for randomised trials embodies a more modest approach. Unlike what the braggarts and blowhards would have you believe, there's a lot we don't know about the world. Whether it's raising employee satisfaction in your company or reducing inequality in our society, achieving significant goals presents substantial challenges. So, rather than going off hunch and supposition, why not try experimenting more often? If you're sending out an all-staff message, why not test two versions and see which is more likely to be read? If you're running a health program for the first time, why not use a waitlist design to run an experiment on its effectiveness? Provide the program to one randomly selected group of employees for the first 6 months and then to everyone else. Or if you're providing new AI tools, why not roll them out sequentially and test their impact on productivity? Or if you're considering a new interviewing strategy, wouldn't it be better to first run it across part of your company and then see whether it's more or less effective? We all make mistakes. The question is, are you learning from yours or are you repeating them? For more productive businesses and better government, try a randomised trial. The results just might surprise you.